Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Before we leave this section here of, you know, what do you think's going on and stuff there, I want you to kind of summarize, if you would. Now, you were on a panel at Sunstone. It was a debate, supposedly, between four different visions of Joseph Smith. One was that he's, what was it, the... It was Dan Vogel, and he spoke about him being a pious fraud. In other words, he sort of knew he was using deceptive things, but he did it for good reasons and things. And then they assigned you the title of Joseph Smith, a sincere visionary.
Right.
Okay. And then we had one who that he was completely a con man, and then we had Joseph Smith as a prophet as the, as
yeah,
the,
and
fourth,
the
fourth
con
position.
Man was Smith.
Yeah, Chris Smith, and then Don Bradley did the final one, which was Joseph Smith as prophet. But I guess, Anne, did you feel comfortable with that description of Joseph Smith as a sincere person? Because as I read this chapter, I felt more comfortable with it in the sense that you seem to think that whatever's going on with Shookman, with Bill Wilson, with Joseph Smith, they're claiming stuff that's, you know, true experiences to them, and by you bringing in and seeing what's happening with these highly hypnotizable subjects and kind of applying that there, it seems to you that you don't sense that Joseph Smith in any of this is deliberately deceiving, or that he's, you know, what he claims is, hey, it's the gift and power of God, I'm not going to explain it any further. That's something that, you know, he really might not have known exactly what was going on. He just knew that these words were coming to him, he'd speak them out, and this was the result.
Yeah, I think that's entirely possible. I'm coming at this from a religious studies point of view and trying to see if there's more interpretations that are possible than the ones that come across to me as highly polarized. And so some of you know the paper that I did on the golden plates, where I took as my starting point that there were no ancient golden plates, but that Joseph Smith was not a fraud, that he sincerely believed that there were, and at the same time was not deluded. So I set myself the challenge of trying to see if I could come up with any way to make sense of that, that set of conditions. And where I came out is something like what Ron was talking about earlier, that I thought or think it's possible that he could have made an object, made plates, that he believed that the Lord made into ancient golden plates, along the lines of the brother of Jared account.
Right.
So I think that there's definitely evidence for him believing that as a seer or later as a prophet, that he could take a pretty active role in being a seer or a prophet and still wholeheartedly believe that that's what he was doing. So I think that the very bifurcated kind of view that you can't, if you take any agency, if you're not totally passive, then it can't be God. I think there's a lot of religious traditions that wouldn't agree with that. And I see Smith as potentially fitting into that kind of point of view.
Yeah, and if we had more time, I would love to have you, you know, talk about other religious figures and other things going on in Joseph Smith's time and period that sort of, I don't know, you would never say Joseph Smith's normal, but in some ways it kind of contextualizes in a way that says he's not completely out there on his own. This was kind of in the air. These types of things were happening, and people were using objects and all that kind of stuff all around him.
Right. I mean, I think that I don't think that the use of the word normal. I'm stumbling over your
right,
words.
Right. I know. And it was a weird word.
I think that founders of religious traditions tend to be somewhat unusual, and that they have gifts or abilities or insights into what's possible. I tend to interpret them as highly creative or insightful people that in a sense can see things that other people aren't seeing and give voice to that in one way or another. So I think they're unusual, but I think, you know, the people that become most famous tend to be unusual in one way or another.
But he's not the only one in these categories.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Ron or Mike, do you want to jump in at this point? Otherwise, I want to take us back to just one last revisit of the church seeming to prefer the words on stone section. But I want to go ahead and do any more of this. What do you feel about the hypothesis that, I guess you both liked Anne's basic hypothesis that something's going on here with his head in the stones, and that it's more of a revelatory process than a mechanical process.
It's like I started out as a music major, and one of the reasons I did so is that I had written some music and it seemed to come kind of naturally to me, et cetera. And then they stuck me in a class where I actually had to craft musical text. I had to compose. And I found it so mechanical, so mathematical, that I couldn't do it. I backed off. I was not a technician. I think sometimes there are people who, I went to a performance of Rachmaninoff the other night, and it just blew me away at how this guy can cough up this kind of stuff. It's absolutely inspiring, that is so far and elevated above what the norm of society can do. And I've thought a lot about this through the years, that the kind of whatever it is, the wherewithal inside someone to craft something musically, which is oral, aural, A-U-R-A-L, and not oral. We're talking about people right now who the manifestation of their genius is something that ends up in readable print, as opposed to somebody who does something musically, which also ends up in print, but it's a very different process. Or is it? And that's right. What my question is this feature of this, the extraordinary, that allows people to do things that are inexplicable, either musically or literarily. Both Anne and Mike have thought about this much, much more from me, and I'm just talking from the cheap seats right now. But it seems to me that Joseph is in that class, that it's very difficult for people like me to be able to describe what people like him did.
Well, I like the concept of gift. And we use the term gifted very often with musicians. But I think it also applies to people like Joseph Smith, gifted. And I think of Mozart, who, before he ever studied math, was using mathematical principles in composing as almost a toddler. And that's a gift. It's a gift that came without formal instruction in all of the mathematical elements of composition that you resisted. And for him, he didn't have to be taught. It was just, he had this unique, whether we call it a gift or genius, he, as a child, internalized that and then was able to put it on the written page and record it so that other people could look at that page and use the instrument that they were familiar with to create the very same sounds that came out of his mind. And I'm not sure that we'll ever understand that process, because even the people who are able to do it don't seem to understand it. It's just something they do.
And they can't describe, at least they generally don't describe what they've done.
No, and in fact, I think it's because they don't understand how they do it. It's not something that's conscious for them.
Yeah. There's a great line from the movie Good Will Hunting where he's trying to explain to his girlfriend that, you know, he's this raging genius about math, but he talks about Beethoven and how piano just made sense to him and that he could just sit down and play. And then he goes, when it comes to this math stuff, he goes, I can just play. You know, he doesn't,
right.
Just for whatever reason, we don't know it. But of course, that leaves, Anne, you brought in Joseph Smith's mention of the use of the Holy Ghost as being the key thing. And in some ways, we're moving away from a lot of Mormon folks' comfort level here when we're saying, where is God involved in this process or something like that, if we're just going to kind of put it in the naturalistic means. So, Anne, you don't rule that out, but you're kind of saying, as a scholar, you really can't play a ton with let's insert God into this process.
Well, I'm in a naturalistic phase in general right now, so okay. I'm not giving supernatural. I'm not saying the Holy Spirit is operating somewhere else, but not with Joseph Smith.
Right. Okay.
I'm trying to explain any religious phenomena I'm looking at in more naturalistic terms these days.
I don't know if this new article in the Ensign, I haven't read it, uses Paul. But for me, the Apostle Paul, in writing about the metaphysical, uses a phrase that I just often refer to, and that is, we see through a glass darkly. And the idea that he uses a glass is nice, because that's also what many people call Joseph Smith's seer stone, a glass. And when we try to understand the metaphysical, we do not get it. We get shadows of it. And even those who experience it don't really get it.
Right.
They have the experience, they can write it down, but very often they're not sure whether they actually saw a person or whether they saw a vision of a person that someone next to them wouldn't see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this experience in the New Testament with Jesus and the people who were around him who did not hear what he heard. So I really like that concept that Paul emphasizes. And I think that the problem with many Mormons is that not only Mormons are more literal than I think they should be, but Mormons have this self-confidence that they understand the metaphysical completely.
Right.
And that's a kind of spiritual arrogance that leads to this emotional and sometimes faith crisis when they're confronted with the fact that, no, things don't quite make sense.
Yeah. So with the church emphasizing words glowing on the stone or something like that, my guess is the reason for that, contra what Anne and we've been talking about here today, is the sense that they want to still double down on the, this is an ancient text. The plates are a real record of ancient people who lived on the earth, etc. And so they want a far more mechanical process than just Joseph Smith going to a special, you know, kind of state within his mind where words flow and ideas appear and things like that. They want something more than that, as something that they see that members of the church need faith-wise. Would you guys say that there's a truth to that, or is it, or do you think that they're simply thinking that Royal Skousen's, you know, who's the main proponent of this, as he's sorted through the evidence and as he's looked at the original manuscript pieces and things like that, do you think that it's this, they've bought his argument in here, or is there something towards this that they think it's more, faith is more salvageable when it's a more of a mechanical process than Joseph Smith in some kind of interpretive state? Ron, I'm going to start with you.
Well, as we discussed yesterday at lunch, Dan, I think the one of the pitfalls that has plagued us is that we've generally had a sense that we can prove our faith, that Mormonism is, I've got a book on my shelf, with the title of that, Can Mormonism Be Proved Scientifically? Well, faith just isn't that realm. And we've set ourselves up for disappointment, by so many who have said, because there's this evidence here or this evidence here, it proves that Joseph did this, or it proves that this happened to him. And I think if we can ever get over that hump of having to have things be demonstrable in a courtroom kind of a thing, that maybe our faith can mature a little bit and allow us to be able to see some of the things that I think Joseph Smith was trying to teach us, that we have we've kind of mechanized, and it makes it much, much more difficult for us to be able to explain the ambiguities when we don't have answers, and to try to explain the conundrums when the multiplication of correct answers may be many. We've set ourselves up, and I think that's one of the problems that confront people in the church today, and it's one of the reasons why I think we respond the way that we do, as I've suggested in this forthcoming article, at least what it seems to me, and I'm very respectful of the people who wrote it. They're very, very bright folks, and know Joseph Smith, know the documents very, very well. But it's something that we're kind of hanging and hearkening to that is, in my judgment, antiquated.
I thoroughly agree with Ron in this. I think what he said eloquently, and he said precisely in the way that I regard these issues. I think that as believers, whether we're looking as believers as Mormons, or we're looking as believers as Christians, or we're looking as believers in only the Hebrew Bible, that we need to recognize that faith, there are things that can demonstrate our faith, that can demonstrate that we have faith in things that are real, that, and yet I think we set ourselves up, as Ron has said, for severe disappointment and alienation if we think that our faith can be proved scientifically. Because scientists are often wrong. And sometimes they fight against new evidence because they are wedded to a particular way of understanding physics or whatever it might be, their field. But eventually they'll say, well, I was wrong. The evidence, whether it's in geology or whether it's mathematical or whatever it might be, the evidence is overwhelming, and the point of view I clung to for many years is wrong, or it has to be revised. Well, that's the scientific approach. Well, I don't think that faith should have, you know, set itself up for that kind of acknowledgement. I think faith should begin with the premise that there's so much about God we cannot understand, we do not understand, and just be grateful for those glimmers, those dark and enlightened places through the glass that we see, that Paul referred to, where we do glimpse a part of the wonder of God and God's works among humanity. But I think, you know, to try to use the liar's approach or the science approach to faith, I think is very dangerous.
Yeah, it's a category mistake. You know, we're trying to get answers from one realm of knowledge and empiricism or something for what's never gonna yield satisfactorily through those categories or those lenses. Okay, I'm not positive that we got to exactly what I want to do. So, Anne, maybe I'm going to have you try my question, which is, what do you think the church is up to with this emphasis on the words? Do you sense that they're trying to salvage faith in the book as an ancient document, whereas it sounds, and Mike, you certainly believe that because you believe Moroni was a real person, et cetera, came to Joseph Smith.
Yes.
The records were doing that, but we're kind of been playing in this more fuzzy realm of, hey, words came to my mind, I spoke them, and they were complex, and they were in a flow state, and I could stop, and I could start, and we're all into this sort of little Joseph Smith was doing something that none of us have the talent to do kind of thing, but we haven't played with you know, the correlation between what's on the plates and what came out.
Well, I draw on another perspective of a 19th century ardent believer in the Book of Mormon, and that's Brigham Young. And Brigham Young said, were the Book of Mormon to be translated today, you know, something on the order of 3 decades to 4 decades after it was translated by Joseph Smith, it would be different. It would be very different.
But materially different.
Yeah,
yeah,
so
materially different.
He wouldn't have names like Nephi and Lehi and all
oh,
that?
Oh, I don't think it means just names. I think that he had this perception, and he put it in other words in other sermons. He said that God speaks to man according to their knowledge, according to their understanding of the world. And so he had what I call a fluid understanding of revelation, but he also very clearly had a fluid understanding of what translation meant regarding the Book of Mormon,
right.
that if it were translated by the gift and power of God 4 decades later, it would be substantially different. Well, that's a hugely important perspective from someone who said that he was an apostle of Joseph Smith and adored Joseph Smith and treasured everything that Joseph Smith said in the name of God. So I really think that although there is a comfort in this automatic kind of perception of translation in the Book of Mormon, and although there are elements of Hebrewisms and Egyptianisms and other Near Eastern isms that one can find in the meaning as well as some cases the wording in the English translation of the Book of Mormon, I think that to regard that translation process as written in stone and unchangeable, no matter who is the translator by the gift and power of God, not only is dangerous, it just simply flies in the face of what Joseph Smith's successor said, who was certainly not a skeptic.
Right. And Mike, and I guess where I'm going ultimately here, that I want to kind of have us wrap up with sort of a, like, what would you say to somebody who, through no fault of their own, naively assumed this other stuff and now they're struggling? For me, all the things that everyone's been talking about today, you know, over a good dozen years or so, this sort of started to distill upon me as a richer, you know, more inspiring in some ways. It freed me up from lots of, you know, dead ends or things that might, you know, keep me in certain channels. You know, all this stuff has been a boon to my faith and my enjoyment of the Book of Mormon, for instance. But it took me a long, long time to kind of get there. You know what I mean? And it was this slow distillation and stuff like that. And so I guess I'm trying to say, do you, and maybe I'm just the wrong thing, you know, trying to read the tea leaves of what the church is doing. Why is it that they're doubling down on this? Are they afraid of that dozen-year process? Are they afraid of this? Yeah, go ahead, please.
I tried to jump in a little bit ago, but I had my mute on, so it failed.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah, so really I've got two thoughts. One is that when you keep pushing this question, you're kind of holding up maybe that the church, in your view, didn't go as far as it might have, but it strikes me that in getting out the pictures, and now I would imagine maybe revising those pictures of Joseph staring directly at the plates and translating, that's a pretty big step
there. Oh, I'm thrilled.
Okay, so that's one thing. You know, so maybe it'll take the church a few steps to get, you know, the visuals in sync with the historical documentation. But I also wanted to comment on the science business, because I think that science has gotten really caught up, or the use of science, in the either-or mentality. So Ron and Dan were talking about the use of science to try and prove religious truths, which they don't think is a good idea. And there's the competing side, which is the use of science to try and debunk religious truths. And I'm really much more interested in a whole different perspective on the role of science in relation to religion. And I think it gets at the place that you're trying to go, which is that if we're curious and interested in how these processes work, we can look at the brain mind as a mediator of these experiences. That whether you believe that the Lord or the Holy Spirit was acting or not, as long as you think that the Lord has to act through our physical bodies and our minds, then we can use the scientific study of the mind and brain to try and figure out what processes might have been involved. And we may not, you know, that's a long process and it's going to be discussed and it won't be gotten right in the first time and we'll just keep working at it. But I don't think people need to be scared of that, because as long as they think that God is using our bodies to convey religious truth, it's got to work some way or another.
Exactly. It's got a map there. Yeah.
I agree.
As do I.
And solves all. Okay, so are we done with my question about, I mean,
I think that you're setting up, in some ways, you're setting up a straw man in the sense that you're assuming that there is a coordinated effort to argue for a particular literal point of view on the words being written in stone or appearing on a stone. And I'm not sure that the First Presidency is really doubling down in that way. I think what they're doing is they're trying to emphasize to the saints that these essential scriptural documents are the Word of God, and they are the literal Word of God. But literal, you know, having, in my view, a flexible meaning. And they're also saying that here is some new evidence that you should incorporate within your concept of the Book of Mormon as the literal Word of God, and I see them trying to do that bridging of the conventional folk belief, folk wisdom, which in some ways has been encouraged by church headquarters for more than 100 years, but to say that you know, here's a new way of understanding the Book of Mormon, but in presenting this evidence to you, we want you to still maintain the position that we maintain, that Joseph Smith was God's prophet on earth for the latter days, and that the Book of Mormon is true. So I think on the one hand, they're trying to do two things. They're trying to maintain faith in the literalness of prophet and of the Book of Mormon as scripture, but also trying to expand the perception of the Latter-day Saints generally of what that means.
Good, yeah. No, I don't disagree with you.
I think it's kind of a remarkable thing. This is kind of a sociological perception, I would suppose, that usually the church has crafted its curriculum and distributed information about our identity to newcomers into the church, so that it would be compatible for the many folks who are coming in every year. This is a gesture toward a more seasoned group of Latter-day Saints, and I don't remember anything quite like this, at least in my lifetime, where the church has overtly has influenced what will be the future curriculum of the church with information that we would say came from the scholarly realm. So I think this can be looked at in a very, very positive light as being something that will contribute in the future to maybe a larger and hopefully more perceptive understanding of our past and how it affects our present.
Yeah, no, I agree with that too. I guess here's my thing, and I am celebrating this move, but I am saying I see a problem here in that they. So I was really, my early question was, have they just been convinced by Royal Skousen and that view as the dominant one, or was there something else? And I agree with Mike that it's probably not this major coordinated effort. But for instance, when they did the gospel topics on polygamy, they seemed to me to simply say, but we know that an angel with a flaming sword, you know, came to Joseph Smith and commanded this. And that was sort of a way of still saying God was in charge of polygamy, and you know, lots of us have wondered about that whole flaming sword, you know, kind of thing, but the church has chosen it. Same thing here, they seem to be choosing to say these words that are now in your Book of Mormon were given by God, and the more mechanical, you know, the most mechanical view that they can give, given, you know, at least some ability to argue through through the sources and things like that. That's what they've chosen to do. And in some ways, that, you know, that's a setback for somebody like me. But on the other hand, I'm kind of one of these guys that simply says, if somebody doesn't panic, and in some ways for me, it's my own working with the Spirit. How does God work with me that has made it much more okay for me to imagine that that's how God worked with Joseph Smith too, in some sort of combination way with my own mind, my own thinking, my own preconceptions and things like this, and still being something that feels outside of me, that feels like it wasn't generated from my own mind and heart, in some combination way, you know, pretty profound. Powerful shifts have happened in my life, or, you know, I've gotten wisdom that I'm still clinging to and holding on to as, you know, very meaningful. I can measure a before and an after from those types of experiences. So I guess I'm just trying to say, in some ways, I think if we don't panic as a church over this and let it sit on our hearts and work with the Spirit ourselves, it becomes, to me, like I was saying, so much better. I like the view that doesn't have words appearing on the stones. That was a ramble from Dan, just kind of giving you my take on stuff. Does that totally seem out of whack for any of you guys?
No, it does not seem out of whack. But again, I still return to Paul. We see through a glass darkly. And we get lights and shadows. We see images, but they're indistinct,
right,
of the metaphysical. And I find great comfort in that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, some people who are listening to this podcast don't believe in any kind of metaphysical stuff.
That's true. I have said in the past that, you know, that's a rational point of view. It's just not one that I you know, that is mine.
Totally. Okay, so here's what I just want to end with, and Anne, I'd love you to even jump in here, but maybe I'll let you go last after you hear these guys. So, because you guys, Ron and Mike, interact with people, Latter-day Saints, all the time, or you've in the past, you know, certainly heard the story of what happens when something comes along and says, that's not the way I was taught, and this is my last straw, you know, how many things are going to change, you know. Everything that, you know, ever appears in the library of a church, for instance, these pictures of Joseph Smith's translation process, if they have this sear stone, this black or this dark chocolate stone in their vault all the time, they knew that it was there, and yet they still let these pictures out here. So we got this big cover up, this big deception thing. The internet's forcing them to do this right now. How do you, like, calm, you know, let's stop and think, or what are framings that you guys put on this that, you know, again, it's the person has to do their own work. They have to do their own internal, you know, bridge too far, or what's the calculus that lets me still value my own experiences with the Book of Mormon now that the whole process of how it came is all screwed up. What's some good big framings? Ron, I'll just let you start, go to Mike, and then Anne, either speaking as a warm-hearted observer to Mormonism, you know, maybe you have analogies from other religions too that you've seen. That would be great. So let's try to make this kind of a final round. Not guaranteeing that we'll stop though exactly afterwards.
Being a church employee in the history department for as long as I was, there were many people who came to the history department looking for answers. And they were looking, I think, for reinforcement more than they were answers. I remember one person saying, well, the fact that you've studied these things all these many years and you are still a believer, that's enough for me. I think there's that level of people. And
right,
they can probably accommodate most anything, but I found that people who have become unsettled because they feel like they didn't hear this in seminary, or they didn't hear it in institute, or it was not part of their Sunday school curriculum, and they certainly never heard about it from while they served a mission or something to that effect. And I keep hearing this word betrayed.
Right.
And it seems like it's extreme to me because, I mean, I found my way through all this kind of stuff, and I admit, and because I couldn't make it in the musical world, I had to resort to something that was less taxing. So I came into history.
You're too hard on yourself.
No, I'm just joking here. Anyway, the idea of individuals having to reconsider the worldview that they have, I think is, first of all, a healthy thing.
Yes.
I don't think it's a bad idea at all. I also remember somebody that I've kind of a somewhat of a guru that I've followed through the years who once said that in speaking to a group of college people, he said someone came up to him afterward and said, "What's the most important thing that you've learned?" And he said, "The most important thing I've learned in my life is how to deal with ambiguity." We haven't done a very good job of that. And it's a hard thing to do. And it's, you know, I've been reading a little bit in Martin Marty's seminar on fundamentalism, and fundamentalists have a real hard time with that. Religion doesn't make sense to a lot of fundamentalists if there's much ambiguity in it. And so I think we have to describe what we're talking about here in terms of who exactly is it that we're trying to appeal to, because certainly Mormonism is made up of a huge composite of people, and it isn't just ardent believers and non-believers. There's the continuum's huge. I have said to people after who've come to me, some of them as a last resort, after a few minutes, I've said this to several of them. I said, "Well, you might as well stick the fork in now, because you're done. You're not. You can't recover what you once had, because it was based on misperceptions, misunderstanding, ignorance, etc."
Even though you came to all those positions honestly, without, you know, you thought you were right in the pocket.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, in many ways, our problem is, and I'll finish with this, is we haven't taught people how to think.
Yeah. So is that an unforgivable offense, or how is it that you can
it's part
be
of a human it's part of the human process.
Okay, so not just a Mormon thing.
Yeah, I don't know how I would change things radically and do differently. I cross my fingers about people that I care about, hopefully that they'll be able to hang on to something that gives them some meaning and peace in life. But I can't supply it to them from my own experience. We kind of all have to do this ourselves.
Okay. And let me have you add in if you want to on this. And Mike, I'll feed it in for you to kind of give a framing, if you would. One thing is that, you know, on that deception level, or, you know, I've been betrayed or something, from your experiences with general authorities or those that would give talks that would emphasize things that we pretty much would now say are factually wrong, do you sense that they were aware that they were doing that, or what's the level of historical astuteness, would you say, from the people who have perpetuating these understandings?
Thank you for giving me that slow pitch over home plate.
Okay. You jump in then, and Ron jump in after Mike takes this one to the house.
I have two personal anecdotes of a conversation I had at age 17 with Apostle LeGrand Richards, and a conversation I had at age 37 with Apostle Gordon B. Hinckley, who was then serving as a counselor in the First Presidency. At age 17, I asked Apostle Richards about something doctrinally, and he said, I don't understand that, even though it was an essential question about the nature of God. And he said, I don't understand that. And I don't want to make a judgment about it because I don't understand it. And so I put it on the shelf. And I may end up having to leave it there until I die and can ask those who passed before me, prophets and seers and revelators, what they meant by what they said or what they wrote. And I just thought that was a tremendously, not only comforting, but a modus vivendi, a way of living as a believing person, to not expect to understand even some essential things and to be willing to put them on the shelf. When I was 37, I had a conversation of about an hour and a half with Gordon B. Hinckley in his home, in the library of his home, the study. And at the end of this discussion, and the details of what we were discussing aren't as important as what he said. And he said, you know, you have probed, and many others have probed, church history and the documents of church history more than I have. And you know many things about church history, and other researchers know many things of church history that I don't know and that I doubt any of the general authorities know. And then he said to me, or he expressed to me, his concern that speaking and writing about these things that we knew from our research that general authorities themselves didn't know because all they had was what they'd been taught by their seminary teachers with the knowledge that their seminary teachers had right. about church history, that this could be very disruptive for the members of the church. And that was essentially the bottom line of the advice he was giving to me as a historian who specialized in Mormon documents and trying to understand the meaning of events and documents in Mormon history. So to those who feel that they've been betrayed, that's based on an assumption that their seminary teachers or their institute teachers or their BYU religion teachers or the general authorities themselves were withholding evidence that these revered people knew and were actively deceiving the students in the class or the membership generally. And even though this Searstone was in the vault of the First Presidency, the men who entered the First Presidency don't review the things that are in the vault of the First Presidency. That's the delegation that they gave and have given for 150 years or more to the secretaries of the First Presidency. They're the ones who know what's in the vault and the details, and they're the ones who are expected to be the custodians of not only the minutes and other written records, but also the artifacts, such as the Searstone. So I am convinced that many of the modern members of the First Presidency knew little or nothing about the existence of the Searstone.
So you wouldn't say that any of them, when they see these artist portrayals that are factually wrong, because there's no Joseph Smith with his head in his hat, and they have him looking at the plates and all that stuff, you wouldn't say that any of them had any red flags in their head that said, I know this isn't the way this really happened.
No, because as Gordon B. Hinckley told me when he was a counselor in the First Presidency in 1981, in November 1981, when I was in his home one Sunday at his invitation, he didn't know many things about church history, and he doubted that any of the general authorities did.
Right. Right. It's they're mostly in a pastoral role. They don't have time for the historians. They may not have the inclination for it. When they're perpetuating the wrong story, it's probably in service of a doctrinal point or some kind of faith promoting point, rather than like, I'm now teaching you history. You know,
right.
So that's how I've always been able to do that too.
Well, even when they're referring to history, they're referring to the history they learned in seminary.
Exactly.
Sunday school.
And everyone assumes that that was good history.
Right. And so that's the perpetuation of that kind of group knowledge that is limited, far more limited than the evidence would allow, but it's what they know. And so they pass it down in private counseling, they pass it down in books they write, they pass it down in sermons they give as prophets, seers, and revelators, but they're not passing down what they understand to be deception.
Right.
They're just passing down what they understand.
Yeah. Ron, fold you in real quick here, and then I'll let Mike make the larger point. Same sort of sense from you about the knowledge level and whether there's any active, I know this isn't exactly right here, but I'm going to teach it anyway.
Well, it's very evident that many of the church leaders today are becoming much, much better informed. I know that in the last 20 or so years that I was there, there was a concerted effort on the part of several of the leaders to become informed about anything and everything that arose regarding developments in church history, new documents, new ways of looking at things. Didn't necessarily mean that they bought into it, but they wanted to be informed about it. So I personally know that there are a group of church leaders today that really do know a great deal about what the historical climate is. For example, in the Joseph Smith papers, there are general authority reviewers, and the Smith papers people publicize that. So some of them, not all of them, it's impossible for all of them to do that. But some of them are engaged in trying to get some perception about what is happening in the modern arena. And I tip my hat for that. I think it's terrific. You know, in many ways, that one of the reasons that they weren't informed in the past is that the church history group itself was quite ignorant of the collections that they held. One of the real concerted efforts that I saw while I was there working in the church archives was to try to create better finding aids that included descriptions of what we had so that we would have an intellectual understanding of our collection. You can't administer a collection very well if you don't know what you've got. And in the last generation, the increase of understanding on the part of those who administer the church history department, that has just blossomed in an exceedingly fine way. And so they're not fighting it. They're not turning a blind eye to it. I think there is a genuine concerted effort. We're going to try and do things better. And when you see the Leonard Arrington diaries published in the very near future, you'll see some of the very early entries about Leonard's interaction with Howard W. Hunter. And in 1972, Howard W. Hunter was where we are right now. It just took quite a while for a lot of his colleagues to get up to the point where they were willing to say, you know, this is our past. Let's learn to understand it so that we can minister in a way that is going to be credible and authentic.
Thank you. Anne, I just want—we haven't heard your voice in a while, and I know you kind of had to leave before the rest of us here. So, would you, you know, just offer an observation here at the end about this moment in Mormonism? You know, these couple of decades, but you know, immediately what's happening this week, and you know, do you have advice or do you have a framing that might be nice to hear?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would really stress to your listeners, which is really picking up on Ron's last point, is how big a deal the publication of the Joseph Smith papers is. I mean, and that's building on the changes within the church history community within the church that Ron was just talking about. But to have all that material not only published in books but accessible on the internet, so that it's all out there, I think that is a huge event. And history has typically been the thing that most religious traditions have had the hardest time dealing with. I mean, dealing with the full scope of the sources about their beginnings and development. And as you probably remember from your time at Claremont, you weren't in the theological curriculum over at the School of Theology, which is not the same as a Mormon LDS seminary. It's master's level seminarians who are training for Protestant ministry. But we routinely anticipated that the first year of master's study was going to destabilize most of the entering class, because they were going to be exposed to historical critical methods for studying the Bible and the history of Christianity. And it invariably shook people's initial faith. I mean, the faith that many of them grew up with. And over the course of that first year, they typically wound up putting their faith back together again, but in a more complicated kind of way that could deal better with the kind of ambiguity that Ron and Dan have been talking about.
Yeah, and that's great. And within a year in seminary is like an average person's probably 5 or 7 years or something, because it's so intensified. And I remembered it happened to me with my master's program at Arizona State. But luckily I had professors that I could talk to that says, hey, it gets better, and I'm with you, brother, I went through it myself, etc., and stuff like that. And so normalizing this is what you just did there, and I'm super grateful for that perspective. What else are you seeing in Mormonism in terms of you know, any advice to those who are destabilized right now?
Well, I think you just made a good point that, you know, when you're in a context like a master's degree program where people are kind of used to this sort of process, I mean, the faculty are, and it's a more intensive kind of period where you've got...
This is all I'm studying, yeah, you know.
Right.
It's not
but
normal life.
Different from normal life where you've got a lay church where people are doing all kinds of other things. So I think things like you're doing with this podcast and other kinds of support structures that people can find where they can ask their questions and explore these issues in an open context without feeling like they have to jump one way or the other, that they can really exist for a while in a questioning space where they give themselves a chance to figure out what they think and let things emerge over time. To me, that's, I guess, where I'd go with it.
Wonderful. I'll cut you loose, friend. Thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks for having me.
Love it. And we can't wait for your book. I'll make sure to mention it when it comes out. And I'll link through my Amazon portal and stuff like that to your other books that are available. And hopefully we'll sell some copies for you.
Okay.
Not that you came on for monetary reasons. But Mike and Ron, I'm going to have you guys stay on a little bit longer, if you would. But Ann, thanks again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Goodbye.
By all means, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, bye, you guys. I really enjoyed talking with you.
I'm really thrilled for this discussion, and I know this last hour and a half has been especially a little more right where people are. We kind of did in the early going a historical overview, and we kind of, you know, got a sense of seer stones and Urim and Thummim and all that kind of stuff. But then we got into this process of Joseph Smith as a revelator. How did you guys all of a sudden, or was it all of a sudden, how did the two of you come to embrace the mix of the human and the divine, maybe in Revelation? Because I think that's the hardest thing here. You know, Joseph Smith, whatever's happening, I tend to believe that he's in touch with something larger than himself. But on the other hand, I know that, you know, at least half of whatever he produced was mixed with his personality, with his expectations, with the worldview that he already operated and things like this. And so his language, his concepts, everything sort of colored this thing. Would you guys say that was the hardest hurdle for you? And is that maybe what a lot of people are facing here now as they look at this chocolate-covered stone and say, I don't see any way, shape, or form that this was a divining tool, but I wonder if there's some way that I could still call him prophet, if there's some way that I could still call the Book of Mormon scripture. Is it making peace with that mix of the human and divine? Is that the key? Ron, start with you.
Well, as all of us, we change over time, and our experiences cause us to think differently about things that we once held a particular view on, and I'm no different than anyone else. I think that, I've always been a believer in the credibility of Joseph Smith as a prophet, the authenticity of it. My views have altered over a number of things, but I believe that those kinds of things are true to the record. My views are not informed by some other interpretation. I've tried very hard to understand the context of his life, and so my views about him, and I've read as much bad as anybody has, so I've read the critics. But my feelings about him and about what he did and what he was trying to do are informed by the documentary record. And I don't claim to know everything by a long shot, but I've become pretty familiar with most of the material while I, especially in the last 10 years of my employment when I was the associate editor of the Joseph Smith papers. So, mine's been an experience of increase and acceleration. I've had to ask hard questions, things that didn't make sense to me, that there's many things that don't make sense to me today. I remember this same guy who said the thing about ambiguity once said that he thought it was pretty presumptuous of some biographers to write biographies about people who are like 10 times smarter than they are. You know, that's the way I feel about Joseph Smith. I make no pretension about understanding so much of what he did. But I think there is enough of a paper trail, enough of a documentary record that will allow someone today to make a rational judgment about Joseph Smith and his authenticity. Now, some people are going to come up with the Dan Vogel model that he was a pious fraud. There's no way to preclude that. And there'll be some people, because of whatever baggage they may have, that's a negative word, whatever worldview they may have, will not accept it. But I can only speak for myself that there's enough that is digestible. There is enough that is authentic for me, besides you know, personal experiences that I'm not going to run away from this because somebody twists my nose or offends me or something like that. I really believe that something that Anne played on, that is the publication of the Joseph Smith papers, while it's not going to be the end all and not going to be the final answer. There were a lot of people who were, as we were trying to conceive this, wanted to make the Joseph Smith papers a commentary on the documents. And we realized very early that wasn't the way to go. The only thing that we could really do was to annotate them, to provide a bit of context for them, so that people could digest them in as dispassionate a way as possible. So that's really saying a long thing. I've tried to help people who have had their faith shaken. And at one time I actually was almost energetic at it, you know, but I don't feel that way anymore because I don't think I do anybody any good. There was one fellow I'd been having a conversation with over the years, who was a member of the state presidency in an eastern state. And he'd call for several months, and the state president wanted to fly him out here to talk to me, and because he thought I was giving him some concrete answers. And then I didn't hear from him for about 4 months. And he finally called back up and he said, I just want to thank you. And I felt such relief. He says, yes, I want to thank you for helping me out of the church. Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, I said, so
even though there's a there for you with Joseph Smith, no matter what you did, yeah. his worldview or how he adds up evidence versus whatever,
yeah.
It just didn't work the same way as yours.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ron, for being on, and thanks for this. I think you've offered a ton here. I'll maybe give a final comment that might throw back to something to have you comment on. But let's let Mike turn Mike loose. Mike, I kind of framed this with the idea of the mix between the human and divine that I think is involved in any kind of process. And I kind of heard that coming through for you earlier. Was that a hard hurdle for you? Can you relate to those who are maybe standing on the front end of that? Man, I got to really wrestle with that particular mix. I kind of want it to be different.
People's experiences are often very different, but in terms of how they're introduced to Mormonism, whether they are generational Mormons or whether they're converts or their parents are converts. I grew up in the mission field in Southern California. But the ward I was in had people who had ancestry, very prominent ancestry, way back. They were sons or daughters or grandsons or granddaughters of prophets, seers, and revelators. And when they would talk at sacrament meeting, and sometimes in their testimonies, but more often in sacrament meeting, they would tell anecdotes about the leaders of the church. And I grew up as a kid with understanding the prophets, both the current prophet when I was growing up, who was David O. McKay, as well as prophets that some of these people in their elderly years could remember from childhood, or mm-hmm. that their parents talked about going back to the 19th century. And frequently they would give anecdotes that were humorous about the humanity of these general authorities, that was a part of their calling as prophets, seers, and revelators. And I think the analog that would be true for many members of the church today would be J. Golden Kimball stories. that he was a general authority, and yet in his own experiences, he unintentionally, it turns out from his diaries, made people laugh, and he didn't understand why he was so funny, and he didn't understand why they were laughing from the audience, but he was just a hilarious personality in the way he expressed things and in his very open humanity. And that's how I grew up. I grew up knowing that
you weren't
David
mystified.
O. McKay
yeah,
was
yeah.
the speed demon on the freeway and just would exceed the speed limit on the highways. They weren't freeways then, but on the highways by 20, 30, 40 miles an hour. And that Heber J. Grant had all these human qualities that some people had seen in their own interactions with him and that they recounted over the pulpit. And they weren't saying these things to demean these individuals, but very often they were telling these anecdotes as warm personal stories of how the brethren of the present as well as the distant past, their characteristics, but their characteristics were very human. And so growing up with that background, it just somehow prepared me for seeing the humanity of Joseph Smith, and that he was a human being struggling to hear God, to do as God wanted him to do, to recognize that when he was chastised by God, as Doctrine and Covenants frequently does, in God's revelations to him, and to pick himself up from those experiences and to do better. And so that was how I, at a very early age, internalized my understanding of prophets, seers, and revelators. And when I read the Book of Mormon and the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament, and eventually when I read the Old Testament, when I or the Hebrew Bible, when I was 17, I saw the humanity of the prophets, and it just to me just seemed very, you know, just a very much a part of what it means to be a prophet, of what it means to be a revelator.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get more into but this is the revelation part of it, you know. I get the human beings, weaknesses, personalities, etc. But I think that it's so hard for people to simply say that somewhere in this process of receiving revelation, you got a big chunk of that prophet and not just the clear phone call from God. You know, these are like a special class of revelations.
When I was 16 in our word library, I read Joseph Fielding Smith's Essentials in Church History, and then I read B.H. Roberts' Comprehensive History of the Church, and in that volume one, he talks about the Canada Revelation, which has now been published by the Joseph Smith Project, Papers Project. But B.H. Roberts talked about it and quoted what David Whitmer said about it, that Joseph Smith told David Whitmer that some revelations that he might give are of God and some are of the devil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I read that as a 16-year-old. So, I mean, I incorporated that view, which was
pretty
published
early
by the church in as an official document, the Comprehensive History of the Church, published in 1930. I read it when I was 17 or 16, and that became a part of my understanding of the humanity.
Nice.
Is that it affected as well their revelations of what they said in the name of God.
Yeah. No, that's great. And you are a bit of an overachiever and a young starter on all this. So, you know, but yeah, I do think we have to get there. And I know that I just wanted to kind of say to listeners or something like that, I got there, but I didn't get there early. I got there later, and I was blessed in many ways, like I was talking with Anne, to be in a context where this was my full-time job, to go into this, you know, as a student of religion, philosophy of religion, theology, you know, enough history to have all that come along. And I was able to do it in an intense way, and I did have good mentors and things like that. I still had to do the work. I still had to do the reframing, but I got there, and I actually got there, and I said this before, to where I now enjoy Joseph Smith so much more than I used to. I enjoy scripture. I enjoy this process when I can think of it in this big ways. And especially as I said earlier, when I can relate my own experiences with spirit, with these moments that feel somehow different than all the others, I know that there's me in there, and I know that there's God in there, and it's this weird alchemy and all that stuff. And I can't, you know, like Mike says, you can't really describe the metaphysical. You can't really get your brain and your mind around it. But somehow or other, you know, it sits on my heart well that this could be it. So the big hurdle, I think, right now that people are facing is the strong folk magic, seer stone. I don't get this. How did this object somehow interplay with Joseph Smith's mind on all this? Ron or Mike, anything on that particular hurdle besides, you know, studying it out and just kind of realizing that it was part of the air back where Joseph Smith was?
Well, you know, in the business world, they say that it's location, location, location. In my experience in Mormonism, it's context, context, context. And our ignorance, which really is abysmal from most of the members of the church. And it's understandable. I mean, they've got to keep body and soul together. You got to raise families. You got to go to school. You got to make a living, all those kinds of things. I don't know how somebody could be or very many people could end up being full-time students of the religion, but that's almost what it takes. Or at least someone's got to have some zeal in saying to themselves, this stuff's pretty important, and so I'm going to find out about it. And I think if people took that approach, instead of being able to slide by, as so many of us have done in so many different ways, that the level of ignorance would diminish. And I think you'd see a lot more people who were able to deal with, able to juggle multicolored balls. And so it wasn't just the difference between a white ball and a black ball. So I'm hopeful that over time that, we're going to become a little bit more adept at dealing with information and becoming a little bit more energetic about being informed. And I think the natural result of that will be fewer people with consternation. If many people go another way, well, that's, so be it. But at least they've done so from a position of being informed rather than jolted out of their seats.
Awesome. Mike, you gave us great framing on the magic worldview kind of stuff. Any help there on that specific part of it? Is it just a matter of it's such a different world, and the fact that we're all more post-enlightenment now than they were then, it's going to be hard to enter into it? What would you basically tell people?
Don't feel that you have to understand everything right now. Be willing to accept the Apostle Paul that we see metaphysical indistinctly. Be willing, like Apostle LeGrand Richards said to me, to put things on the shelf, even essential things, and not make judgments about them, and be willing to possibly even keep them on the shelf throughout the rest of one's life, as he said he might. That's what I would recommend.
Yeah. You know, when you told that story, I was wondering, the shelf analogy is all over, you know, the last few decades of stuff. Do you think you introduced that to Mormon world, the concept of the shelf that you
put things
on it? To you. Right. Yeah. But it was just dawned on me that, you know, people use it all the time. I'm wondering if you're telling that story somewhere early on and someday was when it became part of the...
Oh, I can't. No, I doubt that. No.
Okay. Uh-huh. All right. That's fun. Well, thank you. I think you guys model just really wonderful things. You know, obviously this amazing information base that you have, lifelong wrestles with this material, still some reasons for, you know, allowing the metaphysical to be alive and to even know that it's messy, but there's just something profound and important for us there. And I just appreciate you guys being willing to spend 3 hours on the phone today.
Well,
crazy.
Thank you for
and sharing. Well, it's been great, Mike, and thank you, Ron.
Thank you,
Ron,
so much,
and
man.
I appreciate sharing this time in cyberspace with you.
Boy, the feeling is mutual. I have so much respect for you, Mike, and all the good that you're doing, and I look so forward to what you're going to do in the future.
Thank you.
Awesome.
We'll see what I'm able to get into print, but the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak, and we'll see what happens.
Well, we're glad you're in Utah plugging away up something more, so thanks to both of you. Listeners, thank you for hanging in there. This was a long discussion, twice as long as I expected us to go. I hope it's been worth your time. Let me add just here in post-production, Mike and Ron are now off the air, and this is Monday afternoon, the day that I'm going to release it. Let me just, you know, do some typical closing business, but also just to add once more a couple of thoughts here about all of the dynamics of wrestling with things like seer stones. You know, the historical record is never going to be something to be afraid of for us. I know institutionally it certainly there are some reasons why there's voices that you know panic a little bit as there's a mismatch between what that record says and give the way it's been talked about for years. But I think we're going to get past that too. It reminds me a lot of scripture and how we can just, you know, look at the actual scripture itself or a little bit of context about the history that was going on at the time and say, how on earth are we interpreting that as a messianic prophecy or some reference to Jesus Christ or something like that when it clearly, clearly wasn't even in that author's mind whatsoever that it could be talking about that. You know, we'll pick something out and we'll raise that up and it's completely out of context. We did that wonderful podcast episode on the Book of Job with Michael Austin. And, you know, for instance, all those references to I know that my Redeemer lives and things like this, they're, and Satan even in that one, they're clearly not about that. But are we going to blame 2 centuries of Christian interpreters for that? Especially when, you know, the scholarship has only probably been in the last 100 years or so that have really started to question that. But this idea of blaming or having an expectation that somebody who has the Spirit of God is going to somehow say, wow, that scripture is way out of context, and they'll kind of know through whatever this amorphous, fuzzy way that the Spirit works for them that there's a problem here, and I'm going to dive in and I'm correct. It's just a crazy expectation for us to put on them, and it's the same thing that I feel like with church leaders and whatnot, and even, you know, historians throughout Mormonism, as they wrestled with the record, we know that plenty of people can look at the same record and think that it says something different or give weight to certain things or whatever. For us to think that they've, you know, systematically decided to tell the story wrong, I just think it's a mistake for us to think that. And so, you know, seer stones are never going to be comfortable. You know, I am a product of the 20th century, and that is not a means by which I would ever think to approach God or to kind of get myself into it. I would much more likely, and I do, go to my knees, go to other postures, put myself in certain frames of mind, use different language, whatever it is, I just do things differently to get myself in touch with things that are really operating at a level below my consciousness. It doesn't mean that there's not some mental parts of it, that there's not some rational, you know, things, that there's not language and whatnot that's involved in kind of that intuiting of what's below. But it just means that, you know, you don't access that easily when you're walking around in your daily life and you're just, you know, primarily in your head and things like that. So the same thing, Joseph Smith to me is simply, this was a tool for him, and it was kind of normal in his day, or at least within his family and the region in which he, you know, grew up and what he inherited from others around him. I'm approaching God in normal ways for me, but I think we can make something of a statement that says, we get in touch, certainly never perfectly, never unmediated pure knowledge, but we get in touch with things that have an energy and have a power and you know, are somehow warmed by something else more than our everyday stuff. And I think that's what happens with Smith. I believe that's what the Book of Mormon is. Whether it's historical or not, it's a product of somebody in a state where things came to his mind and he said them out loud. And there are times that that stuff soars. I taught a priesthood meeting yesterday and shared a section of, you know, and some dynamics. I've even shared it on the podcast before. And there's just no way that that wasn't fundamentally true stuff, that there wasn't a dynamic described in those scriptures that, you know, is breathtaking. It is like, clearly you kind of just have to go in your heart, whoa, that is insightful, that is important, that's worth chewing on some more. And so that, you know, whatever the Book of Mormon is, it's that. And if there were seer stones involved with it, which obviously there were, getting there, he got there. And then as some people have said over those coming weeks, and we didn't really mention it on the podcast or in these last few days, we hadn't yet mentioned, it's the work, it's the production, it's, and then it's our experiences with that work that to me is where faith is, you know, that's where it needs to be centered, and that's where it is centered within my life. If it's important to know who we are, if it's important to kind of say, I want to walk through life with the idea that there's something bigger and more meaningful, it's worth being in the question about. You know, I know when I remember in graduate school going, damn, you mean I've got to wrestle like everybody else? I was Saturday's warrior. I was had it all figured out. I, you know, and you know, there was a loss and a grieving process and things like that. I've said all this before, but you know, once I kind of rallied my resources and stuff like that, and I dove in and said, man, this is so much more complex than I thought, it also became more beautiful, it became richer, and that's what, you know, again, one person's sharing with you that there can be some neat results from deciding to stay with a question rather than saying, you know, oh man, this wasn't exactly like I was promised. I didn't get exactly, you know, the version of a prophet that I wanted, you know, even though, you know, I also kind of know that as I look at other prophets in the Old Testament or even other around the world or people who I want to call prophets, I know that their complexity and I know that not everything they do, you know, somehow I wanted this Joseph Smith to be an exception to that. Well, it just isn't going to happen, but we just need to dive in and it's just worth staying in the question. It's worth examining our motives. Am I picking on some historical fact or a person's argument that's really kind of weak, but I'm looking for a reason to jump out of Mormonism or something like that? Let's just make sure that we, in all of our questioning and whatnot, that we're being as self-aware as possible. Because, you know, especially for those of us who are raised in the church, you know, to leave your religion, Oh man, that is honking, especially if it's a big part of your family, if you've had a big track record with or something like that. That is not easy stuff, and I don't know that we can ever really ever know the consequences. So if you feel like there's a there, let me just add that extra little note that I think you can have a rich, wonderful, abundant spiritual life. You will be a transformed person. You'll be the kind of person that you want to be, even within this church, even with founding leaders and certainly all the leaders since them as being mysteries to us in this complex mix of the human and the divine and all that stuff. So I have spoken way longer than I planned. Let me just close with that and just wish you all the best. There is nothing more that I want for you than for you to live your biggest, best, brightest, most abundant life. I think it's in dialogue with spiritual things or archetypal things. You know, what William James says, it's those questions or those things that they cast the final stone. They're the things of eternal import and things like that. And so I hope that we'll constantly have that neat wrestle with it. And it won't be a wrestle, I promise you, of, oh, I just want to reduce cognitive dissonance, or I'm going to do gymnastics so I can kind of go back to the way I was. You know, Ron said that great line in the podcast about, stick a fork in it, you're done, because guess what? You can never go back to that. That is so true, but it isn't it isn't inauthentic for you to push. And I think the more we push Smith, the more we push the historical record, the more we push in our own hearts and things like that, you know, there's good stuff ahead that can lead to that big life. But even if it's not within Mormonism for you, you know, I want it to be a life of yours in dialogue with the biggest things. Because and even if you need to take a break from it, there's that there's definitely the need for sabbaticals from time to time and stuff. But you know, hasty decisions versus slower decisions. I'm always going to say, take your time. Don't be afraid of casting the net widely. Read widely. Listen to lots of people. Just because it's in print doesn't mean it's a good argument. anyway, all that stuff. So again, see, I've continued even on longer than I expected once more. So a couple of things. I'm going to link to all the books by our different panelists. I hope you'll support them. And if you found anything of interest here, please do it. I'll link to them through the Mormon Matters portal, the Mormon Matters bookshelf. But there's also just an Amazon portal on the Mormon Matters website. So just anything you want to buy through Amazon, I haven't reminded you in a while. If you don't mind going through the portal that you get from the Mormon Matters page, you can buy anything there, and it's a way to support the podcast. I get anywhere from 3 to 6-7% on some items of just anything you sell just by you having linked through my portal. But of course, donations in terms of monthly subscriptions are just like, hey Dan, here's X amount of dollars as a boost and a saying thanks for letting me chew on something good. That's, of course, something I love, and I'm crazy about you guys. I'm crazy about this position that I've got here of being able to host this podcast and talk with you and be part of a dialogue about important things. It's a real privilege, and I'll always try to honor that, and I won't always do three-hour podcasts in support of that. But just know that you can write me and call me up or whatever, and let's be in dialogue together. So thanks very much. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening. Hard to you, this journey may appear.
as well.